Welcome into the latest edition of ESPN FC. I'm Sebastian Salazar. Good to be with you on this Thursday. Plenty to get to in this show in just a little bit. Jan Arge Fjordtoft and Craig Burley will join me to discuss the latest comings and goings in the Bundesliga. Alejandro Moreno and Frank Leboeuf will be by as well as we remember a pair of Champions League finals on their respective anniversaries. But we begin with some big news out of the Premier League, who have set a date for a return to play. It'll be June 17th. For all the latest on that, make sure to check out the website, ESPNFC.com. We begin on the field in the Bundesliga. And let's take you back to what the Bundesliga table looked like when play stopped back in March. It was very, very condensed. Top five teams separated by just 8 points, the top four by just six. Dortmund trailed leaders Munich by 4 points, Leipzig 5 points back. Now, since the return of play, just three games later, Bayern have opened up a 7-point cushion on Dortmund, a 9-point cushion on Leipzig. We'll remind you, they were the winter champions. Leverkusen, Mönchengladbach, they're still in there in the fight for the final Champions League spots. Jan, Craig, good to have you with us to discuss the Bundesliga. Jan, I'll start with you. I remember when we first found out the Bundesliga was going to be the first league to return, I was telling a buddy, if there was one league to come back, it had to be this one, because we were going to have a legit title race. I'm accustomed to being wrong, but what happened?
It happened that Bayern has done what they always do. When the goings get tough, when we get into March, April, May, you know, we kind of delayed it a bit, going into May, they are always brilliant. It just sums up this round that Bayern took 3 points. Leipzig, Dortmund, Leverkusen, and Gladbach took 2 points. This extra day in the German league. I mean, we can hope for Dortmund. We can say they are challengers. They have great talents. But then Bayern just turns up with a great balanced team, do whatever they have to do. And then Kimmich, of all, do a brilliant winner for them. Okay, Dortmund should have had a penalty when Boateng used his hand. But still, at the end of the day, you just felt that was deserved, Bayern. Have we seen it before? Unfortunately, yes, the last 7 years.
Craig, we might have expected Bayern to win the title, but not after 3 weeks.
Yeah, well, I mean, technically it's not one yet, but I mean, when you look at the fixtures got coming up, I think they've got to go to Leverkusen, they've got to play Gladbach, but they're playing a couple of teams either in the bottom three or close to the bottom three, so it is very unlikely. Look, Bayern, and Jan touched on this a few days ago, Dortmund couldn't afford to lose the game, but to give all the rest of the teams a chance, Dortmund really had to win, and you got a feeling that knocked the stuffing out of Gladbach, Leverkusen and Leipzig. I mean, Leverkusen losing 4-1 at home to Wolfsburg, a team who are close to them, but still, you're at home. The argument has been made without the home fans, it is more difficult for the home teams these days, the advantage is gone. But Bayern made a big decision, Sebi, back in November. They didn't mess around. You know, Kovac, the appointment of Kovac wasn't working, and they made the decision to chop him. And Hansi Flick came in, and it was absolutely the correct decision to make, unfortunately, for the rest of the Bundesliga. If Kovac had still been there, and there were still the same issues, then it might have been a tighter race.
I might take the other side of that, Craig. This is the year that Bayern should have slipped, right? They had to fire their manager. They've had boatloads of injuries. Jan, if the chasing pack didn't catch them now, when are they ever going to catch Bayern?
It's a very good question because, well, we have criticized Bayern for not kind of replacing their big stars. I mean, last year they said, well, we give Robin and Ribéry, we'll give them another season. They looked a bit not old, but not that hungry. But quietly now, Bayern has kind of done a generation change in their team. I mean, the young players now like Kimmich and Gnabry and Koeman and Davies, sensational. Alaba now seems an old, experienced player compared with these. I mean, and then they will get Sané from Manchester City, and they will most probably get Havertz from Leverkusen. And who's going to stop them? I don't know. I think the biggest opposition for Bayern is Bayern themselves. And Craig said it. If they kept Kovac, they would be in trouble because he kind of, although he was a former player himself like Flick in Bayern, he kind of took them away a bit from that Bayern DNA. And I think the symbolic thing is about Thomas Müller, who is Bayern. That is the man who symbolized the way they are playing. And he's on fire at the moment, 17 assists, always involved. And then they are Bayern, and Bayern can only beat themselves, unfortunately.
Craig, of the two closest chasers, Dortmund and Leipzig, who have both fallen back, who have you been more disappointed in since we've returned to play?
Well, Dortmund did win their first two games, and they were against teams that was around about them. Obviously, Schalke have had a tough start, but you know, ultimately, I think Leipzig have been more disappointing, but Dortmund I expected a bit more. The interesting thing, and I don't know what the reaction has been in Germany, and Jan can maybe answer this, is what, has there been any questioning of the Lucien Favre's team selection, Jan? Because we talked about it 24 hours before the game. What was he going to do? Was he going to go with the same team, or are we going to bring Can and Jadon Sancho, two key players, back in? He left them on the bench. He brought them back in at halftime when arguably Bayern were managing the game. Has there been any reaction in Germany, and particularly Dortmund, to Favre's team selection?
Well, I 100% agree with you, Craig. I also said before the game that how can you not bring Sancho in when you knew that the only chance they had was that the offensive Bayern will make high pressure and they will have a lot of space in first half. And they did. And it's too easy to say afterwards when Sancho came on, he didn't look well. He didn't play as we expected him to do. But I mean, the space he had in first, he could have had in first half was enormous. And they put Can on at halftime. And I think that the team selection of Favre was wrong. He's been criticized in Germany because that culture, that winning mentality that Dortmund would like to have to be the challenger to Bayern is not even there. So Favre, straight after the game, he made an interview and said, I know what's going on here. I will tell you in 2 weeks' time what's going on. And the next day, he backpedaled a bit and said, I didn't mean that. But I think that it's all about who they could bring in. I mean, I'm a bit surprised, although I like Niko Kovac, that Niko Kovac comes forward as the biggest candidate for them. I think that the Dortmund fans will see something else. They don't want to see someone who was kicked out of Bayern. That is a bit of a proudness of them. But I think Favre made a wrong team selection. Would have won? I'm not sure. But I know that Sancho would have taken advantage of all the space they had in the first half.
That's an interesting point, because we talked about this right after the game on the show, and Dan Thomas was arguing, oh, you know, well, it's all very well saying Sanchez should have played, but look at him in the second 45. He didn't do a great deal. But that was the point we made, Jan. The space was there in the first 45 minutes, because once Bayern got that lead, they used their experience. They got the two blocks in front of the penalty box, and they could pick and choose when they went forward and hit on the counter. So for those people out there that are saying, oh, you know, Sancho didn't play very well when he came on, we didn't see his pace, there was nowhere for him to run into, whereas in the first half, there was space for Brandt to run into. There was space for Hazard to run into. But that was denied in the second half. So for those out there saying, well, hindsight's a wonderful thing, the game early on was there where you could hit on the break-in behind. As Bayern wore the game on, the space in behind just dwindled and it wasn't there for the likes of Sancho and others to operate.
Guys, we can't talk about Dortmund without talking about Erling Haaland. Jan, you first on this. Obviously, he was blanked in the game against Munich, VAR potential penalty aside. But before that, on the weekend against Wolfsburg, zero shots on goal. So back-to-back games with no goals. Any worry about what you've seen from Haaland in the last two matches?
Not at all. I'm more amazed that he had that period just scoring goals for fun as a 19-year-old. I think the away game against Wolfsburg was one of those days where it didn't happen for you, and your American friend Brooks was doing well against him. Against Bayern is always hard. This is hard for a guy like him to do it. I think it's more worrying that he crashed with a referee and got an injury. I mean, I've seen a lot of things in football, but I have never seen that before. And he is now out against Paderborn. He's not playing for Dortmund this weekend. I think we have to be patient with Erling Haaland and any 19-year-old on and off the pitch. They will have games that they won't score, then they will come back again. I think that against Schalke he looked ever so fit, and that is just 10 days ago. So he'll be okay, but let's never forget that he is 19. We can't expect him to do wonders every game that he plays.
I thought you Norwegians were tough, Jan. I've played with a lot of you Scandinavians. What's happened? You're getting injured back and into your referee. What's happened to those tough Norwegians?
Well, they say if you crash with a referee, you can't see the referee be carried out, can you? But it was we were sitting watching the game, and I was texting desperately around in the Dortmund area, and there was not too many in there, and I just got a text, just watch, he's crashing with a referee, and quite likely. But you've never seen Ellen Johnson, your teammate at Chelsea, crash with a referee. Then the referee will probably be dead at the moment.
All right, Jan, you mentioned it, Dortmund playing Paderborn on the weekend. Let's take a look at the rest of the Bundesliga fixtures. Action gets underway on Friday. Freiburg and Leverkusen will meet on Saturday. Leaders Munich are at home against Fortuna Dusseldorf. And as we mentioned, Dortmund against relegation dwellers Paderborn on Sunday. Speaking of Dortmund, Thomas Delaney joins Gab and Jules on the latest edition of the Gab and Jules podcast. Make sure to download it this week.
Though we're apart these days, we're sharing more. So, at GEICO, we'd like to say thanks. Thanks for sharing your savage dance moves. Thanks for sharing your DIY haircut fails. Thanks for sharing your inner lip-sync star. Now, it's our turn to share with the GEICO Giveback, a 15% credit on car and motorcycle policies for current and new customers. Because we're committed for the long haul, the 15% credit lasts your full policy term. Visit geico.com/giveback for more info and eligibility.
Foot odor throwing you off your game? Stick to a winning game plan with Odor Eaters, featuring 3 advanced odor and wetness fighters. The lineup provides long-lasting odor control plus more to keep your feet on their game.
Odor Eaters powder provides outstanding moisture control. Clear drying spray is the MVP in preventing athlete's foot, while insoles work continuously to manage wetness while adding a layer of comfort. Pick up today at Walmart, Target, CVS, Dollar General, or other fine retailers.
Odor Eaters. Destroy foot odor with the best in odor defense.
Crazy to think about. 9 years ago today, May 28, 2011, Barcelona won their fourth Champions League title, beating Manchester United 3-1 at Wembley Stadium. Pedro, Messi, David Villa, the goal scorers for Barcelona. Wayne Rooney, the goal scorer for Manchester United. Craig Burley still with us. He was on COCOMs that day. Alejandro Moreno joins the show as well. Craig, start with you. What are your memories of that match?
Well, it was a perfect night at Wembley. It really was a perfect night for playing football. The weather was absolutely beautiful. Pitch was perfect. Set up between two of the biggest teams. And we saw some great goals, including Wayne Rooney's goal, but it was eclipsed by Barcelona's three. I can't remember seeing a team pass the ball as slickly as Barcelona did that night. As the game wore on, they just took total control. And obviously, that midfield of Busquets, Iniesta and Xavi was legendary. And, of course, a younger Lionel Messi, who they stepped off Man United for the second goal. You just can't do that. But I had to remind myself, Pedro with that great first goal and David Villa, a guy who was here in Major League Soccer as well with the great third goal. It really was a truly tremendous performance from Pep Guardiola's Barcelona.
Ale, was Barcelona's fourth Champions League. It was Messi's third Champions League title. As you look back on it now, does it feel like kind of the height of Messi?
It was definitely the height of Barcelona. That team that they beat in that final, that Manchester United team, was a very good Manchester United team with a lot of good players and a lot of players with a whole lot of talent and great and successful careers. And that day, they were made to look pedestrian. They were the sort of team that you thought we could dominate a match, not against that Barcelona team. Manchester United never got close to Barcelona. And I think the 3-1 result kind of paints a picture, but not really. It wasn't even that close. The possession by Barcelona, the inability of Manchester United to get anywhere near the ball or anywhere near Barcelona players to try to pressure. Any time that they tried to get close, Barcelona just passed the ball on. They kept moving with and without the ball. And it is largely considered the best team that we have seen in the Champions League era. This Barcelona team was outstanding. Now, as to whether it was the height of Messi or not, he was at his very best. But we have seen so much great things or so many great things from Lionel Messi from there on out that it's hard to say, well, that was the height of his career. I would suggest that it was the height of Barcelona. We saw a whole lot of great things from Lionel Messi years after that as well.
Craig, the possession stats, 68% possession for Barcelona. Even that almost seems generous from my memory of the match.
Yeah, but, and sometimes we throw out these possession stats and they're kind of meaningless in a way, but not on this occasion because it was It was possession with a purpose. And I always like to say that because, you know, possession without a purpose and without a plan is pretty, you know, it's pretty mundane and pretty pedestrian. But it was a real purpose about the way they passed the ball, the way they moved it around, the little triangles in midfield, how they stretched Manchester United. And as Ali said, they were made to look, and I'm being nice here again, pedestrian. Look, the one thing I would say about this, and apart from the 90 minutes plus of the match where it was clearly a magnificent performance, the story for me was seeing Sir Alex Ferguson in the tunnel in Man United at Wembley after the game. Not personally seeing him, but walking through after my media duties to see him being ushered to a press conference, and he walked past me about 10 yards in front, and he looked absolutely shell-shocked, because here was a guy who had built some of the greatest teams in Europe, certainly in England, over a 20, 25-year period. He was renowned as one of the great managers of his generation. And he just saw his team, which was an excellent team, been taken apart. And he really looked shell-shocked going to that press conference. And I think that told the story. He knew he could be beaten on that night at Wembley, but I think he was absolutely gobsmacked in the manner in which he was beaten, which was, you know, to be given a lesson in how to play the game, which ultimately Barcelona did.
Ale, have we seen a better team than 2011 Barcelona since then?
I don't think so. Not in the way that team just worked together and how in sync they were and the movements with and without the ball and how everybody knew their roles and knew exactly where they had to be. That communication and that feel that you get for your team and your teammates, it's something special. And what we saw from that team is some of the best players in the world at their very best at the very same time. And when you put those things together, then you see that sort of performance. And it's easy to go back and watch this game and remind yourself of how great that Barcelona team really was and how talented they were and how good the movement of the ball was and how much of a clinic this was in terms of Barcelona just having idea, purpose, talent, execution of those ideas, execution of that talent, and then maximizing the full potential of a team. That is a beautiful thing to see. And to see it on a Champions League final makes it even that much better.
Okay, thank you to Craig. Ale, you stick around. We have another anniversary to celebrate way back to 1997, 23 years ago today, when Borussia Dortmund became champions of Europe for the first and only time, beating Juventus 3-1 in Munich. For more perspective on that match, we bring in Frank LaBeouf, who joins the show. Frank, in 1997, you would have been in the middle of your career. What do you remember about this Dortmund-Juventus Champions League final?
I remember a lot because I have to admit that I signed the summer before for Chelsea. But the year before, I was supposed to sign for Dortmund, and Hitzfeld contacted me. But to make the story short, you know, the coach of Strasbourg I had a discussion with him and said that I wasn't the right guy for Dortmund. So they signed Julio Cesar. We didn't play that final, by the way, but I was following that final because I thought that maybe I would have had the chance to play in that final. But life is like that, and I'm very pleased that I signed the year after for Chelsea. So I followed the final, and my friends, French friends, Zinedine Zidane and Didier Deschamps was playing that final. And it was a fantastic final. I mean, I think Juventus, especially the first half, dominated the game, but Riedel was on fire and scored two goals. It was a great final. I enjoyed seeing it, and it was fine and nice in a way to see Dortmund getting his first and only Champions League medal. But because Juventus is such a big club and has so many trophies, that it's nice to share a little bit with others.
Ale, that Juventus team played in three straight Champions League finals. Pretty impressive then that this Dortmund group were able to win it.
And Juventus were the favorites coming into this match. And I think this is when you have to pay attention to the mental part of the game and how things just kind of came together for Borussia Dortmund at the right time. If you consider that it was Juventus that were the favorites, and maybe it was Dortmund kind of saying to themselves, okay, it's us against the world. But then you think, okay, well, this game was played in Germany, and so maybe it's not us against the world. And then there is another aspect to this, that the fact that there is crossover between the two teams. In the starting 11 for Borussia Dortmund that day, you have four players that actually were former Juventus players in Reuter, Koller, Paulo Sousa, and Andreas Müller. And so you cannot ignore the fact that there is an emotional component to this that kind of brought Borussia Dortmund together and said, you know what? We have a chance here. We're going to give ourselves an opportunity. And while Juventus may be the favorite and maybe they'll control most of the ball in the first half and they're going to create some chances, we're going to need some help. We're going to get lucky here in a couple of occasions where Vieri misses a chance here or misses a chance there. Zidane hits the post. But after that, Borussia Dortmund said, we're going to take advantage of our opportunities. And they made it so very difficult for Juventus. And when you thought that Juventus was going to get back into the match, Lars Ricken comes off the bench and scores a beautiful goal. And I guess underreported in this final is the fact that Alessandro Del Piero did not start this final and scores a gorgeous, filthy, nice little back heel and the near post there in the second half, giving Juventus somewhat of a chance. But in the end, Borussia Dortmund too good for Juventus on the night.
Frank, Ale mentions Juventus were favorites. Just how good was that Juve team of the mid-90s?
Well, that was clearly one of the best teams in the world. You know, when you see the names and you see the possibility that they had, especially at front, with players like Vieri, Boxish, Zidane, to name a few, you knew that Dortmund defense would be in trouble, and all teams in the world would be in trouble. But they had I think his name was Klaus in goal, and he was sometimes fortunate, but sometimes very well aware of what's going on. Sorry, and did very well. I think they handled the game pretty well, even if again Juventus had most of the chances in the first half. Very scored a goal. It was denied by the referee for the handball when obviously it wasn't. It was the ball who came to the hand, But it's true that Juventus, we all knew before the game that Juventus will dominate the game. But as Ali said, Dortmund had something special in their heart. Maybe will push them to go further and to get that trophy. So it was again a nice final because, you know, it's always nice when you have a fairy tale and you have one team who never played in a Champions League final and win it against somebody very big who was clearly the favorite but for one night didn't get it.
Okay, guys, enough about the match. Frank, I want to know what the Strasbourg coach said that made Dortmund not want you anymore.
Well, I didn't have a good relationship with the coach. I think the guy was very... dictatorial, and I was playing football because I liked it, because I enjoyed it, not because it was a kind of an army system, and I told him that way, and they didn't appreciate it, and he played. Being younger, he played for Stuttgart, it was Gilbert Gress, and he played with Hitzfeld. And when Hitzfeld called him to know better about me, my agent already told me that Hitzfeld was very interested about me coming to Dortmund. That coach called the other coach, and Gress said, no, he's going to put a mess in your dressing room. He's not a good person. He hasn't got a good attitude, and you shouldn't get it. And Hitzfeld said, okay, I don't want that. And bye-bye, Frankie. So I stayed 1 year. The coach was already sacked, but... he wanted me to have a part of his sadness, I think. I have a regret, even if the year after, again, I stayed for Chelsea, and I won so many things with Chelsea that I'm very happy to. But, yeah, an experience in Germany would have pleased me, yeah.
Okay, Frank, thanks to you. Thanks to Ale. Promise we won't bring up any more harsh memories in today's edition of Extra Time. Ale and Frank are back. The boys will answer many important questions, including what on this hamburger day would they have on their burger.
It's your home speaking, and I need you to do me a couple of favors. First, could you get that blueberry that rolled under the fridge last week? It's throwing my feng shui off. Second thing, bundle your home and car insurance with Geico. It's easy, and we could save money. Lastly, I know you were thinking of painting the nursery back to off-white, but I'm actually feeling this baby blue. Didn't think it was my color, but I am pulling it off.
Geico. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
With thousands of locally owned Napa stores across the nation, chances are that wherever you call home, we do too. So as America starts opening back up for business, and as more of us start getting back out there again, we'll be in big cities, small towns, and everywhere in between, doing what we've always done to help keep our local communities moving forward. So whether you stop by a Napa Auto Parts store, Auto Care Center, or visit us at Napa Online, you can count on Napa know-how.
No shortage of Americans in the Bundesliga to discuss. Why don't we start with Weston McKennie? Got himself a goal on the midweek for Schalke against Fortuna Dusseldorf. Unfortunately, Dusseldorf scored twice in the next 15 minutes as Schalke lost yet again. But for McKennie, it was his second goal in just his last four Bundesliga appearances. To discuss the many Americans playing in the Bundesliga, we welcome back Jan Arge Fjortoff. We welcome in Taylor Twellman. Guys, let's start with McKennie. And Jan, I'll start with you. Schalke have been terrible. How much of that has been down to the central midfielder, McKennie?
No, not a lot. I think he's one of the biggest talent there is around in the Bundesliga. But as you're saying, Schalke is terrible. So even to have a good touch and to get a goal for that team make you a candidate for Ballon d'Or. I mean, Schalke is terrible, but I love McKennie. What a good guy. What a good story about his career. And he's just destined, you know, to go all the way in international football.
Taylor, you as optimistic about McKennie?
I am, because he's still young. However, there's a little bit too many up and downs for me in his game. And what I mean by that, and I actually sat down with him a couple weeks ago on my show Banter, and I asked him, what is your best position? And at times, see, Jan's right. He's an exciting player when he's allowed to go forward, when he's got freedom to run, when he's often the third or fourth attacker inside the 18. But Seben Jan, truth be told, at times, David Wagner has been playing him as a six, and it doesn't suit him. Too often, he's given the ball away in precarious positions. He's lackadaisical at times, ball watching, defending. But when he's more of a number eight, when he's got freedom to kind of fill in the gaps, run around, he does have a special ability to get forward. And I think when he comes to the United States men's national team, that only works if Tyler Adams is playing as a six. How Greg Berhalter figures out those two's key.
Yeah, I think you're right. I would love to have more goal points from him as well. But I mean, the basic got to be that you play in your perfect position. Now we'll see how long David Wagner will stay in his job. Schalke came out today and said they supported him. And we all know that is the first sign of firing him.
Jan, Taylor mentioned Tyler Adams for Leipzig. Obviously, they've had a rough restart to the Bundesliga, but he's been in and out of the starting lineup. What's his reputation among Bundesliga critics?
I think, first of all, Red Bull, or Rasenball Leipzig, as they want to call themselves, have been a lot under attack in Germany. But there's one thing good about them is that their ability to find good players. And Adams is in there. It's very hard to play in that RB Leipzig team. I mean, except for three or four others, I can see him play for a lot of different clubs in the Bundesliga. I knew we were going to discuss this today, and I called a couple of sport directors who would take him straight away. And I think there's a good example of Cunha, who was, of course, at RB Leipzig and is now doing brilliantly at Hertha Berlin. So I think Taylor Adams will I'm very optimistic on behalf of the Americans, but I think that Adams will go his way. But it's very hard to get into that RB Leipzig team at the moment.
Taylor, the question with Tyler Adams kind of has to be his position, mm-hmm. right? We see him with Leipzig, and oftentimes we see him as a right back.
Yeah, I'm so glad, though, Jan brought that up, because when you do speak to sporting directors all around Germany, Tyler Adams' name is brought up right away. The second part of that is, I'm not totally sure he's a wingback, or I'm not totally sure he's a fullback on that side. But truth be told, he's on the radar of a lot of clubs. And the biggest reason why is he's got an engine, he's smart, he's a very natural leader. We saw that with the New York Red Bulls. We've seen it with the U.S. men's national team. This week, I sat with Tyler Adams on Banter, and I flat out asked him, what's your best position? It took him a half a second. He said, I'm a six. I'm a natural six. I fill the gaps. I'm very good at getting in the tackle. Now, reading this performance that he just had recently at Hertha Berlin, we saw moments where he struggled 1v1 defending. I'm not going to read too much into that at this moment after a global pandemic and a break. But he is on an in-between spot as that right back. Now, the question is, and I think Jan's heard this from sporting directors as well, is at the highest level, at the highest international level, he may be a right back, because those sixes are very good in tight spaces, and that's where Tyler Adams needs to improve.
Next American to focus on, John Brooks of Wolfsburg. Now, this guy divides opinion, but over the last couple games, Jan, we've seen him go toe-to-toe with Kai Havertz. We've seen him go toe-to-toe with Erling Haaland, and he's done pretty well, hasn't he?
Well, he's one of those defenders, and I'm some years since I retired now, but he's one of those defenders you don't want to meet, actually. And he has had big problem with, well, a lot of the Wolves, but going from Labbadia to Glasner, of course. But as you say, he's one of those reliable at his best, and he's been good for Wolfsburg, and what a game they had now against Leverkusen. That was the surprise of the round, of course, winning in Leverkusen. And Wolfsburg, there's something going on there, and Brooks will, of course, be a major part in that. So one of those reliable, good defenders that you said, like you said, Erling Haaland, my fellow countryman, he couldn't get a touch, more or less, against Wolfsburg. So that speaks for himself and for him. And also, like you said, Kai Havertz scored 4 goals in 2 games. And, well, there was no many chances against Wolfsburg.
Taylor, you know it. U.S. fans, they've seen the John Brooks that can shut down Erling Haaland. They've also seen the John Brooks that plays against Costa Rica in a 4-0. And that's the difficult part of John Brooks.
That is the most difficult part. Now, quite honestly, Jan knows this as well, Seb. It's a nightmare being a center back, because in the blink of an eye, you could have 89 great minutes, and if you slip up or you lose your man, you're the GOAT, and you understand that. But what Jan hasn't understand yet is what John Brooks has been for the United States. He scores a goal in the World Cup, they win and beat Ghana, and then, like you said, he's an absolute disaster, or he's unfit. And that's been my biggest concern with John Brooks. Is, Seb, how often has he been called in key moments, in big moments, when you need to set the tone in the camp and you've got a center back playing in a top 5 league in the world regularly? You've got a guy that has potential shutting down the best center forward in the world, maybe, in that argument, in Haaland. And then he shows up and he's injured. So if the United States men's national team is going to have any success in World Cup qualifying and ultimately in the World Cup, John Brooks has to be playing at this level and not the level we saw against Costa Rica where they lost 4-0.
Next up on the list, Josh Sargent. Now, you can't talk about a striker without talking about his team. Jan, how bad are Werder Bremen right now?
Well, 2 last games they've done well. They haven't conceded goals, which is a good start. And I'm sitting in the studio with a Werder Bremen legend, Rune Bratstedt, sometimes. And he's kind of so furious of how they're doing. Sargent got it all in terms of physical presence and everything. But it's, of course, very hard. I've been around for some different leagues playing for teams who could go down. And that is the hardest thing for a striker, because you don't create chances. And Werder Bremen at the moment don't create chances. Having said that, I asked the sport directors today, is this a guy, I don't know, as good as you guys doing, because I didn't see the Costa Rica game with Brooks, but when I asked them, should he go down with Werder Bremen? Is that good for a kid? No. Move away, straight away, because this guy got a potential to play in the Bundesliga. He just needs to play in a better team where he gets more chances. And it's quite hard for a guy who loves to score goals playing for Werder Bremen at the moment. Even Lewandowski would struggle.
Taylor, you agree? Should he stick around or not stick around if Werder Bremen do go down?
No, I'm 100% with Jan, because when you do speak to these sporting directors, you have to remember, Seb, and a lot of people in the United States have already forgotten this about Josh Sargent, but he had multiple big-name clubs going after him. Now, I thought it was a little bit of a surprise that he chose Werder Bremen, and then Josh Sargent tells me, well, he goes there because they said he was going to play right away. Well, obviously, we see why, because like Jan said, I don't care who you are up front, that team defends with 10 players behind the ball at all times, and they don't create any chances. So, yeah, he's got 3 goals, 2 assists in 20-some-odd games. But what's more concerning to me is this, is too often I see Josh Sargent playing deep into the midfield, dropping into gaps. If he's going to score goals, which is what he's paid to do, which is why everyone in the United States is excited about his potential, he's got to go play the other way. You don't see Lewandowski filling in those gaps. So whether you're an American or not, you've got to play like a goal-scoring number 9. And that's where I think this learning process is there. But to add on to Jan, I spoke with about 4 or 5 sporting directors in the last month in Germany. Every single one of them said we'd take Josh Sargent right now.
Taylor, what about Gio Reyna? We've done it before, from Freddie Adu to Christian Pulisic. Why shouldn't U.S. fans be over the moon about this kid? Any reason?
No, Gio's special. If Jan probably didn't see it, but we've got a morning program here in the United States, Good Morning America, and he was on with the return of the Bundesliga, and he spoke to Robin Roberts and company, and you would have thought he was 25, 26, 27. Very composed, very mature. Now, the under-17 World Cup was a disappointing World Cup from his perspective, from the United States perspective, but it's difficult to read into just that tournament. But what he's done in his time with Dortmund, how Dortmund has handled him, they keep reminding people, you know, slow down. It's going to come. He's special. He's got the technical ability. We saw the goal he scored in the DFB Pokal game. So he's got the ability to be a special player. He needs to play regularly. I think he's going to get an opportunity to do that. But I love the fact that he's at Dortmund because Dortmund's doing the right thing by a lot of their young players.
Jan, a lot of American fans think he might be the next big thing, potentially a world superstar. In Germany, do they think he has that kind of ceiling?
Yes. And one of the reasons is why did Haaland go to Dortmund? Because he wants to develop as a football player. Why is Reina at the same place? Because you know Dortmund know their stuff. They have people around. They have a coach called Favre at the moment. I'm not sure how long that will last, but they got Sebastian Kehl, who is a symbol of his generation. You have Sork, you have Sommer, they're all hanging around, and they will tell this kid, just be patient, just be patient. Have a look at the players we have developed. Reina is at the best place he can be in the whole world at the moment to develop, and then it's all up to him. The club will be patient with him. I'm very excited for this player. I envy USA that you have that kind of talent, and we have one 19-year-old there as well. So this is the great place to be for young talents at the moment.
All right, the last player on this list. I think it's safe to say we saved the best for last here. Timmy Chandler. What do we make of Timmy Chandler? Taylor Twellman, I'll start with you here. The U.S. doesn't have the deepest player pool. Here's a guy who's not just playing but contributing in the Bundesliga. Is there any way back into the U.S. men's national team for Timmy Chandler?
There has to be. You know, and we're going to hear from other pundits in the United States that will tell you, no, you form is a fallacy and you don't need to do. No. What are you talking about? When you're a country like the United States of America and you don't have the deepest pool of players, Seb, like you just said, and you need anyone and everyone that is at the top form, top shape, then absolutely. Now, listen, many people in Germany don't understand this, but Timmy Chandler wasn't the best in the locker room and coming into a situation where he was a German-American and rubbing a lot of the current players the wrong way. But this is a different regime. That time is over. And here's a guy that's got, what, 5 goals in his last, what, 8 or 9 games? Some of these off the bench? I don't care who you are. You're the United States of America. You failed to qualify for the World Cup in 2018. You can't be picky with players that are in form. You just can't.
Jan, that's just it. Suddenly, Timmy Chandler's scoring goals. What's going on?
Well, I'm very, very happy for Eintracht Frankfurt that we got him at the moment. He's a great lad, and I agree with you, because sometimes you kind of get this thing that a player is finished an international career because you're out some games. But if you are producing like Chandler is doing at the moment, as he did in the last round when he came in and saved us, and I have to say us, because I'm very worried for my former club, Eintracht Frankfurt. They're letting him goals for fun, scoring that 3-3 goal. What a great guy to have around. He understands the Bundesliga, and he's playing in the top 5 league. And I must say, if USA got so many players that you can go away from a player that understands and scores in the top 5, then I must say again, I'm jealous of you.
Okay, thanks, Jan. Taylor, you stick around for a little bit because I want to get your insight on Jeff Carlisle's latest over at ESPNFC.com, that Major League Soccer mini tournament proposed for 2 months at first. Reportedly going to be condensed, maybe back down to 1 month. Taylor, it's a problem a lot of pro sports leagues are facing right now. Is this shorter tournament a better solution for MLS?
Well, yes, because twofold, you get the attention of the players. You also get the attention of the technical staffs. But more so in this bigger picture, Seb, when you really think about it, I think it's because a lot of markets now and a lot of those state departments and governors are saying, listen, you can play in these markets, albeit without fans. So you have a shorter tournament in Orlando. I look at it and say, well, that may mean more games in your markets. Now, as of you and I talking, only Chicago and San Jose are the only two MLS teams that have not begun individual training. So I look at this proposal as MLS looking at down the future and looking into the crystal ball saying, you know what, we may be able to play more games in our home markets than we initially thought.
Taylor, let me ask you this from like a player perspective. Which would you rather? Should this tournament be tied to a regular season down the road, or would you like to see it just stand alone? I'll say this, as a fan, if they're going to do this, I kind of want it to stand alone.
Why so, Zeb?
Because I don't think you can honestly tie it into a regular season. I think it's difficult to plan to tie it into a regular season that we don't know will happen.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Seb. Obviously, if you tie it into the regular season, you have to be pretty sure, if not 100% sure, that you're going to play another 15, 20 games in your respective markets. That I agree with. On the other hand, there's no handbook during a global pandemic. We've never done this. No one's ever done this. So you've got to be progressive in your thinking on how do you make this important. Now, I've said from the beginning, at the minimum, the winner of this tournament is a CONCACAF Champions League berth. Now, whenever that may be, because CONCACAF Champions League is on hold as we speak, but you've got to put something at the end of it. Now, if it was up to me, and I've said this to you already, I would actually say no pay cuts to the winners. Like, put a monetary value to this, but you also got to make sure that if everyone's playing 3 games, 5 games in the group stage, whatever that number may be, and then you're going to play 15, 18, 20 games, you need to make them worth it. Otherwise, then it's just really a preseason tournament, and I'm not so sure that's the return that Don Garber and the Board of Governors really want. I understand what you're saying, but if you have this tournament and, Seb, you know a regular season's going to happen after it, then I think you want to make the games important. Otherwise, I'm not sure you're going to get the full attention of the players and staffs.
Taylor, I'll give it to you. I love your idea of having these guys play for more money or to lose less money, but do you think the players would go for it?
No, the players wouldn't. I think there's a lot of players that have actually heard me say this already. They've tweeted me. They're like, you're completely out of your mind. I'm just saying, if you announce it before the tournament, Seb, and this was at the time when the league was asking for a 20% pay cut and say the winners get CONCACAF Champions League and no one takes a pay cut, that all of a sudden becomes interesting. But will the players go for it? I'm not totally sure they will.
You mentioned the proposed pay cut. The latest report suggests that that's now down to 10%. We compare that to what we heard, a few months ago, and this isn't obviously what was settled on, but Barcelona, we're talking about 70% pay cuts for some of their biggest earners. 10% in that nature sounds like a good deal, Taylor. Is it, though?
I think it is, Seb. I think it is. And listen, I am talking to you as a player. I'm not talking to you as an owner. I'm not talking to you as a spokesperson for the league. This is a global pandemic. There is no handbook. So when you see the players like Messi in Barcelona, and yes, I get it. He makes over $100 million a year. I understand all that. And when you're making $100,000 a year, 10% is a massive cut. I get that. I understand it. But it's 10%. I mean, look at what Major League Baseball just offered those players. You don't think they would take a 10% pay cut right now? And that includes everyone making the minimum in that league. And I get it. There's different numbers. But as a whole, we came into 2020, Seb, and there was a massive undertone between the league and the players that it was a partnership. I understand extending the current CBA an extra year because you have to because of what the global pandemic has brought. But 10%, I'm not sure there's left to argue about. Now, the health and the protocols down in Orlando tournament, I think that's more important than the pay cut, quite honestly, because I think the safety of the players is at the utmost responsibility of the league, and that's at the forefront of everyone's mind. But if you're asking me right now, 10% pay cut as a player, I think I'm signing the deal.
Great stuff, Taylor. Look, if you want more from Taylor, just check out his new show, Banter with Taylor Twellman. The latest guest, Leipzig's Tyler Adams, talking U.S. men's national team and much, much more. Okay, we mentioned this at the top of the show. We now know which games will bring us back on the Premier League June 17th. It is a Wednesday. It'll be Manchester City against Arsenal and Aston Villa against Sheffield United. So some nice fixtures there to look forward to. A reminder, on tomorrow's show, we will have all the latest news on the Premier League's June 17th restart date. Julian Laron will join Dan Thomas and the rest of the gang as Project Restart comes closer and closer to fruition. All right, that's all the time we've got for this edition of ESPN FC. Thanks to Taylor Twellman, Jan Arga Fjortoff as well. Of course, Craig Burley. Thanks especially to Alejandro Moreno and Frank LeBeouf. Why? Because they join us next on Extra Time. Hey there, everybody. Welcome into Extra Time. We have your questions. We have Alejandro Moreno. We have Frank LeBeouf. And we are locked and loaded, ready to go. We start with one of our gentlemen. How much have you missed that, Ale?
A lot. Seth, you know I miss you. I mean, my love for you is peculiar. I would say that. It's special. I would say that as well. But I do miss you.
I did notice you used the word love there. Thank you. That makes me feel very good. Dan, the orange man.
Show the light. Show the light, guys.
Who is the better striker for Milan, Crespo, Shevchenko, or Weah? Ale, as the striker in the house, I'll let you have first crack at this.
Well, I don't think this is close, to be honest with you. I think it's George Weah and is running away with it. He was some sort of special with Milan. And I know that Shevchenko had a few good years with Milan, and some people may make an argument for him, but I just think that George Weah gave this team so much athleticism and explosiveness in the final third. And a guy who, that goal in which we have seen time and time again, in which he takes the ball from one end of the field onto the other, just running by people as if they're not even there. And he was able to do that with consistency, the strength, the power, the finishing ability, right foot, left foot. He was a special player, and people may not remember how good George Weah was. Well, look him up, because he was something else.
If Frank was a coach, how would his playing style be like? What type of coach does he see himself as? And which team would he prefer to manage? Frank, this question comes from Ahmed.
Wow, it's a long question. The style would be pretty offensive, because I like football, and even if I was a defender, I think going forward is the best way to win games. Which team? Yeah, of course, Chelsea. And what was the last question? I don't remember.
How do you see yourself as a coach? I think you pretty much answered that. Offensive, attacking, yeah.
And dictatorial, of course.
Ale, would you play for Frank?
You'd be more of a free spirit, Frank. Just kind of letting the creative juices flow throughout the locker room, and just allowing the freedom for players to express themselves on and off the field. That's what I think you would have as a team.
Yes, I might try that, but with the new generation, I'm not sure it's going to work.
Okay.
It can go everywhere.
Forget the new generation. Let's get back to the old generation. Who is the better Italian player in their prime? Del Piero, Baggio, or Zola? Frank?
Oh, he's first. Answer the phone call. You'll have the answer when you answer the phone call, Frank.
Maybe it's Zola. Zola's calling in right now.
No, it's my mother.
Or maybe she knows.
Excuse me?
Maybe your mom knows. Ask her.
Yeah, no, she knows nothing about football, I tell you. But I will go for Zola. I had the chance to play with him. And, well, that guy was absolutely fantastic. And don't forget that he was named the players of the century of the whole history of Chelsea before he left Chelsea. And, he made the life so nice to us with trophies that he brought because of his talent. And the differences he could make into the game. So, yeah, I will go for Zola for sure.
Ale, did Frank get it right?
I mean, I'll defer to him because he played with the guy, but I have to say, from watching from a distance, if you will, from the outside looking in, it's really hard to turn your head away from Roberto Baggio and how special of a player he was. And not only how special of a player he was, but how special he was in the big stage and how his performances really took Italy to a whole entirely different level. Now, some people may say, well, he missed a penalty in the 1994 World Cup, and that's why they lost in the final against Brazil. They don't get to that final without Roberto Baggio. He was something else. And such a talented and a mercurial talent at that. There was something so special about him. And actually, I would have Del Piero just behind Baggio and Zola at a very close third. All three very talented, very good players.
Frank, what is your favorite French wine, and what player, current or former, would you compare it to? If ever there was a question tailor-made for you, Frank, this would seem to be it.
The French wine, I know it's a Bordeaux, and it's Smith or Lafitte, fantastic wine. And I won't compare it, but I know that Marcel Desailly is a very much into red wines, and then he love that. And I don't want to brag, really. I don't want to brag because I'm going to talk a bit about myself. But some people say, you know, that I'm like the old wine and getting better, getting older. Well, you just to check on the picture that I had, that I have when I was a player, and you see my face now. It's easy to say that I look better because I was looking horrible.
Hey, man. Hey, I don't want to brag, but I'm hot and sexy, baby. Just take it all in. I don't want to brag. I'm just going to tell you, wine,
yeah, but
I'm just like wine.
Ali,
I get old, I get sexy, Ali, I get good, I get nice, full of body. I'm telling you, I am something hot and special.
No, I never say that, Alejandro. I just say when you start from scratch, it's not that difficult to get a little bit better. You know what I mean? That's what just what I'm saying. It's like the red wine.
Oh my goodness!
Very well. I don't think we let Frank brag enough on this show. I think he's quite humble. Ale, this one's for you. Would you rather see Joseph Martinez leave Major League Soccer or Mario Balotelli join Major League Soccer? We discussed this the other day on the show.
Easy. Joseph Martinez leave Major League Soccer. I mean, and it's easy. It's not, I don't even have to think about this one. I don't want Mario Balotelli anywhere near Major League Soccer. I think that's an accident waiting to happen. It's a ticking time bomb. And the only thing that you know for certain is that that bomb is going to blow up at some point.
Ale, aren't you the one that's always complaining we don't have enough characters, we need more villains in MLS? Wouldn't he be perfect for that?
Well, if that villain also brought productivity with him, and that villain actually was a good player in Major League Soccer and wasn't just a malcontent and a headache and a head case and a guy that is just essentially going to bring more problems that he's worth, then yes, I'm all for villains, but yeah. Give me Zlatan all day long, and you can consider him a villain if you want to, but he's scoring a bunch of goals and his teams benefit from it. I don't see that happening for Mario Balotelli, and it hasn't happened for him for years now. And so whatever you think you're getting from Mario Balotelli, it's images and moments that you've acquired over the years, but it hasn't been consistent performances.
All right, then last question here from Peter. Today is Hamburger Day. Have you ever had an Aussie burger? Beef patty, bacon, fried egg, lettuce, onion, tomato, and beetroot. And what would you have on your burger? Fittingly, on Hamburger Day, we would start with Mr. LeBeouf.
Yes, Mr. the Beef. I would get some beef in it, of course, but I never tried an Aussie burger. Don't forget that I'm French. And that as a maybe one day a president of the French Republic, I will forbid any type of burger because it's junky food for me. So I don't like burgers. I don't eat burgers. I think the last burger that I ate was like 3 years ago. I'd rather have a nice meat on the barbecue with a little bit of sea salt, and that's it, with a nice salad. That's it. Now the greasy one, I'm not my type.
Oh my goodness, this guy is a dictator, honestly. Come on.
He's a foodie, if nothing else, huh?
Are you kidding me? I will tell you, I will skip on the beetroot on the burger. I'll say that much. I'm guessing that's pretty good, but I'm going to skip on that. But I do love me a burger. And if Frank wants something that is a little bit of a healthier choice, if you will, go with a bison burger. Tasty and not nearly as fattening as your regular beef. So I'm just, you know, go with a lighter version if you want, Frank. But come on. Let the people eat the burger and Hamburger Day. Don't be that guy. Don't be a dictator. Don't hold us back. Come on, man.
I just want to teach them the taste of culture, something different, you know, a little bit of finesse of how to eat properly, you know. It can be healthier as long as you have the buns. It's not healthy. So you know what I mean? And as long as you have mayonnaise and or ketchup, it's not healthy. So you have to teach the people how to eat properly. That's a big concern in a new world, you know, if you want to get better. You know, we know that many people are obese and we know exactly why.
All right, let's leave it there. For more on Frank LeBeau's war on carbs, you can watch tomorrow's show and the preceding shows after that. I do know Dan Thomas is back for tomorrow's show. Do not miss it. Bundesliga weekend coming up.